Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
The following episode contains sensitive content, including discussion of human trafficking, exploitation, and trauma. This material may be distressing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
This is What's Next on Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, NPR. My name is Jay Moran. Today, we're welcoming back a familiar guest, Kelly Diane Galloway, president and founding director of the Project Mona's House. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
It is great to have you back because you deal with some really, obviously one of the really difficult issues. And we're talking about missing women, human trafficking. At the same time, you bring also a spirit of can-do to this airwave that we really do enjoy. So let's just get into some of the things. Let's just go back for a second.
Okay.
Project Mona's House. I'm jumping too far ahead. That's the problem with being too familiar with each other. But Project Mona's House, this is something that you came across, that you developed over the years. But let's go back to its actual origins. This is from a trip that you took back when you were a student.
Mm-hmm. Well, around the Syrian refugee crisis, I had done some internship work with an organization called A21, ran by a dynamic couple, Nick and Christine Kane. And that led me to Thessaloniki, Greece.
Right.
And so while I was there, I met a woman from the Dominican Republic named Ramona. And she literally changed and transformed my life. She was answering a legit job ad to work as a housekeeper in Turkey. When she got there, obviously, there was no housekeeping job. They tried to force her to work in a brothel. After she refused, beat her up, put her out on the street. And obviously, her number one issue was a language barrier. She only spoke Spanish. And so, again, since the borders were open, it was so many people traveling through Turkey into other European countries. And so she ended up meeting somebody that spoke Spanish and told her if she got on a boat that she would be able to maybe get to Spain. However, she was intercepted by Greek police and put into a refugee camp. A21 did a lot of work in refugee camps. I got to volunteer a couple times, but that wasn't my assignment. My assignment was to work in the shelter that they had. But she was a victim of human trafficking. And because they provided that training to refugee camp workers, they were able to easily identify her because she didn't speak Arabic, Kurdish, Turkish, any language that of individuals who should be in that camp. And so she was sent to that shelter. I was the only Spanish speaker there at that time. And so we developed a relationship, just me, her, and another girl that was also from Dominican Republic. But Ramona and I developed a friendship and a sisterhood. I mean, we're still friends today.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
How is Ramona?
Right now, she is still in Greece.
Oh, okay.
She's too afraid to go back to the Dominican Republic because she feels like she might lose her life. At that time, she was a mom, and she is still a mom and a wife. Her husband has since moved on because she's been gone so long. And the pandemic really put a damper on things because in 2020, she was supposed to be able to get her European passport. So when you're like an asylum seeker, you have to go check in every Friday at the police station. And she was doing all those things. But then the pandemic happened and really postponed things. So she's been taking Greek classes so she can speak Greek. She still can't speak a lot of English. And she's just working there for a family that is a Greek man married to a Dominican woman. And so her goal is to still get into Spain and be reunited with her children.
You said that she transformed your life, and you can tell that you have a lot of feelings toward her. But can you take us through that sense? I mean, obviously, you were in Greece to help out as it was, first and foremost. So there, you already had that kind of spirit about you, for sure, and I applaud you for that. But then to have somebody who actually took you to another place, a deeper level.
Yeah, because I'm not going to lie to you. Prior to that, I was already traveling all over the world, serving in different orphanages, schools, building places, mainly for children. So my experience in Greece was the first time I was actually serving women, adult women, who were victims of human trafficking. And honestly, when I was in Greece, it was a culture shock. But when I was being interviewed for the internship, they told me about the culture shock. I underestimated what that was like. They literally said, like, hey, Kelly, like, you're going to experience racism here. Are you going to be okay with that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I live in the United States. Like, that's fine. But actually, I had never experienced what I experienced there. And so a lot of the women that were in that shelter were brown women from all around the world, because Greece is a destination country. So a lot of times people are trafficked into that place. And then a lot of the other interns were like in their early 20s. I was like, I think I turned 31 while I was there. And so I was like one of the oldest interns, and I was really kind of feeling lonely. And I hadn't been back home in almost a year from my other travels around the world. And so Ramona and I, we were both a little bit older. She was older, a lot older than a lot of some of the other girls that were in the house. We had some similarities. And like I said, we just developed a friendship. Like, she was always up early in the morning drinking coffee. And so we got to talk. And my Spanish wasn't that strong, but she helped me out a lot. You know what I'm saying? So, and I was like, well, I teach you Spanish and you teach me, well, you teach me Spanish and I'll teach you English. And so we kind of did that for a little while. And then you had to monitor their conversations, like if they talked to their families and stuff like that. And because she was a wife talking to her husband who had no education on what human trafficking was, he interpreted her not being there because they agreed that she could go work in that job. And unfortunately, the money that they thought that she was going to be able to earn and send back home, it didn't happen. And so he thought that she just left him. And so literally, they were only supposed to talk to their family 3 times a week for 10 minutes a day. But I just let her talk until she was done talking. Because, again, she had like small children and a husband that every single time she had a conversation with him, she had to re-explain what's happening. And so she would be in there crying. And then when she would hang up the phone, she would wipe her face and then she'll go out there and everybody would think everything is normal. So just even those moments, I think, is what helped us develop a friendship and a sisterhood that we still experience, that we still have today.
So the way you're describing Ramona's situation, she left the Dominican Republic with the idea that she was going to be able to make money for her family to change.
Yeah, just one. She was going to work 1 year, earn $15,000 and open a tuk-tuk or auto, like it's a taxi business where it has like one wheel in the front and two wheels in the back.
Sure.
And so depending on the country, it just has a different name. And so that was going to be able to hopefully end the cycle of generational poverty for her family. And unfortunately, she was brought there under false pretenses and they confiscated her documentation. It literally is like a textbook case of like just trafficking.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get into. Just that idea that she was being offered what she thought. This does tell us a little bit about how people sometimes want to hear what they want to hear. I'm not victimizing her in any way, but I'm just saying it's, you know, and how people can utilize that against you. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that this is a common theme throughout human trafficking.
Yeah, because a lot of times people only talk about sex trafficking.
Right.
But there's also labor trafficking that happens and transpires. Now, when she got there, would they have paid her a fair and honorable wage? We don't know. But she was going to be forced to be a sex trafficking victim. And unfortunately, she got beat up because she didn't want to do it. And unfortunately, they took all her documentation. And so we had to work very diligently to prove her identity, get that back. I didn't have anything to do with like that paperwork type. That's all like the staff that was at A21. But it's just a long process of somebody trying that is trafficked into another country. And it, even if you escape, it's like you still have to prove your identity all over again. That's one of the things that even here in Western New York that we have a hard time dealing with sometimes. When people come to us, one of the things they don't have is identification. And if you haven't, if you don't have a birth certificate, you don't have a social security card, it's like you need this document to get this document, to get that document. And so New York State, we're a little bit fortunate because we have green light laws. I know a lot of people don't like those laws, but that's how we're able to get a lot of the people that we serve identification. Like, I think one of the common threads across all different types of human trafficking around the world, it's just a lack of paperwork and documentation to prove who you are. And if you don't have those things, it can deeply impact how quickly and how easily you can rebuild your life. You can't even get a job in this country without, you're not supposed to be able to get a job
right.
in this country without identification. And like that's one of the, that's like one of the first barriers that we have to cross even at Project Wellness House.
So. Yeah, let's, so like, you know, talking about the situation with Ramona in Greece, mm-hmm. and it's an incredible story, and I think we could probably have a whole show just on that. But then bringing it back home, and you did allude to this idea that this is, here we are in Western New York, human trafficking is happening here in Western New York, and the same tactics that Ramona went through and mm-hmm. had to endure are happening to individuals. Do you want to, can you pencil a number what we're talking about?
I cannot pencil a number because human trafficking, even though it's the second largest crime on the planet, it is like the most hidden crime on the planet. And so I think that's why it continues to like thrive in the shadows. But as far as like individuals not having ID, one thing we can say is like as far as like people moving into Project Wellness House, I think since we welcomed our first resident in December of 2018, I think that we probably only had two people ever move in that had all their documentation.
Oh, my.
Two.
Wow.
And so and we did. We almost ran into some challenges with people being able to get just basic ID within Erie County. But again, once the green light laws are passed, and for those who don't know what a green light law is, it allows individuals, it was really created for individuals who are not necessarily from this country, but are looking to be able to drive legally. And so if a woman could pass, so with very minimal paperwork, if a woman could at least pass her permit test, then we can get her ID. It's easier to get a permit than it is a basic identification card. And so for us, that can present some issues if that woman does not, if she cannot read.
Right.
Because we can't assume that everybody can read. And so there's a lot of work that we have to do just to even get to that place. But in this situation, green light laws help us get women identification more easily so that they can start rebuilding their lives.
And it's interesting they'll use the term more easily. They can get identification more easily. It's still, if depending on language barriers, mm-hmm. reading ability, it's still a bit of a climb.
Yeah, and if you've had a lifestyle full of trauma, a life filled with trauma, you might not test well. It might just be a little bit of anxiety when you got to go over there in that corner by yourself. And again, if they have issues reading, because depending on when their trafficking started, they may not have finished school. And especially like we have some individuals who have a harder time understanding what like basic language, written language, who come out of foster care. And so, and especially if they were at one point a runaway or like running away from it, maybe a dangerous situation or unhealthy situation, something that they felt like, hey, like I'd rather be homeless than or unhoused than stay in this particular situation. Sometimes we run into situations like that. And especially like you don't even have to, technology makes it easier for you to not be able to read anymore, you know, because
right.
you could just talk the text. And so that's why, like, even when we do intakes, we have to do, like, reading comprehension just to understand where they are.
Okay.
So we can
sure.
more easily help them.
Sure. But nobody's turned away because of their
Just to put that out there.
Well, we're talking with Kelly Galloway from Project Mona's House, and we're talking, of course, about human trafficking and the efforts here in Western New York by Project Mona's House to push back against that, to help out victims as well. Interesting also how you mentioned sometimes victims are runaways, but victims come from a lot of different backgrounds, don't they?
Absolutely. Like, I share this story. Like, I will be 41 in August, but as far as, like, my family is concerned, I'm only the third generation born free. So that means myself, Kelly Diane Galloway, I wasn't born on a plantation. My father, Warren K. Galloway, was not born on a plantation. His mother, Sarah Mae Galloway, was not born on a plantation. Now, her father was born on a plantation, and everybody prior to that. And so my point and bringing up that truth is that chattel slavery was the first form of slavery and human trafficking in this nation. People are bought and sold for labor, bought and sold for medical experimentation, bought and sold for sex, and also bought and sold for entertainment, right? And so at that time, you had to be indigenous or of African descent to be a trafficking victim or a victim of chattel slavery. However, now you just have to be a part of a vulnerable population. And so I have a lot of individuals who are like, yeah, human trafficking is wrong. But when we start talking about the pathways that lead to it, when we start talking about food insecurity, when we start talking about foster care, when we start talking about the prison, the pipeline system, when we start talking about how people can't feed their families, and we start talking about normalization of the over-sexualization of children in media, then some people might want to push back on those things. But I'm like, listen, these are things that lead to human trafficking. And so when we're talking about who is, like, well, how do people become more vulnerable? Yeah, foster children, individuals who are unhoused, individuals who are have very high ACE scores, which stands for adverse childhood experiences, individuals who have low hope scores. All these individuals are more vulnerable and an easier target for a trafficker. And so until we address social determinants of health, you will see that there is a large population and a diverse population of individuals who can become labor trafficking victims or sex trafficking victims. However, if especially in New York State, which is where we are, out of all the sex trafficking victims, about 86% of them are women, and then almost 50% of them are women and girls of color.
Okay. Okay.
And so that's my long way of just saying that anybody that's a part of a vulnerable population can be trafficked. However, minority populations, especially minority women and girls, are more susceptible to becoming victims of human trafficking, especially in New York State.
I don't want to get away from the victims, but is this was just coming to my mind, and I don't know how much we've had this conversation, is going from the victim end to what I would say those individuals who may be unwittingly supporting human trafficking, right? People who are consuming this, you know, sex trade, for lack of a better term. Let's talk about that a little bit. What do you see? What do you want to see changed?
There's a lot of different things that I want to see change. So, like, we had a film called Sold Next. We have a film called Sold Next Door that was on PBS for, 3 months, I think, last year. And it just talked about what does human trafficking look like, especially here in Western New York. What I would like to see change is, number one, people understanding that trafficking happens in Western New York and in the United States of America. But more than that, I want them to expand their, because a lot of people acknowledge that it happens.
Sure.
But I want people's understanding and knowledge to expand to understand how they fuel it.
Right.
And so if we were to talk about labor trafficking, we could talk about fast fashion and how that fuels labor trafficking, especially child labor trafficking in other countries. We could talk about, again, and then we so that's just labor. That's just some labor trafficking. But we can also talk about just some of the food that we eat that's harvested by individuals you think that are migrant workers, but they're really labor trafficking victims,
right,
working on farms and wineries and different things like that. When we talk about the sex trade, a lot of people don't understand how pornography fuels human trafficking, how going to strip clubs fuel human trafficking, and how individuals who hire escorts or still pay for sex, you driving down the street or you having a party, a girl's bachelorette party or a guy's bachelor party, and sometimes in this country it's cultural to hire strippers to come in. All these things normalize the sex trade, and so individuals, they put their vices over their values, and unfortunately somebody has to pay that price. And prostitution and exploitation and sex trafficking are all inherently violent. I do a training where we just talk about, like, hey, there's a lot of individuals who say, well, okay, well, Kelly, like, we just believe sex work is work. Well, if that is work, then it is one of the most hazardous conditions to work in, because the number one, like, over 96% of individuals within, if that's work, experience very violent behavior towards them. And one of the most dangerous, hazardous conditions is not death, but it's murder. So it's not like you just die from natural causes. It's somebody is causing extreme harm and you can actually die. And so even when you look at the numbers for human trafficking, so I think when I first met you, I think, like, the numbers were like maybe like 40 million, but now it's over 50 million victims worldwide, and it's still less than 1% ever rescued.
Wow.
So if we don't, like, do preventative measures, most people that get into a lifestyle or are victimized by exploitation, prostitution, sex, specifically sex and labor trafficking, they don't get out. They don't get out. They don't have, at my gala, I might share some success stories and you might hear a woman talk about how she came in as a victim, was transformed into a survivor, but now she's on her way out the door as an overcomer. That is not most cases.
Not even close.
Not even close. When you look at 50 million numbers and less than 1% ever rescued, if take 50 million victims worldwide, even if we combine all of our NFL stadiums, they couldn't even house everybody. If you combine every professional sports field in this country, it still doesn't even gross what the International Labor Organization says that human trafficking makes, the buying and selling of actual human bodies. And I think one of the things that you asked me, well, Kelly, what's some things that you would like to see change? I think I would like people to allow the education and the knowledge that they hear and obtain to change their actions. And I would like them to challenge themselves, like, in what ways am I fueling this industry? So, like I said, PBS debuted, like, Soul Next Door. We're coming up with another film series called Fuel, but it'll be series. So we'll talk about one series to be like strip clubs, one series to talk about pornography, because I think sometimes people just don't know what they don't know.
Right.
So I'm not trying to villainize people as much as I want to educate them, because sometimes you don't know that you're being the villain in somebody else's story. And hopefully education and knowledge and more outreach and prevention work can stop the demand.
And just to cite, like you said, you don't necessarily want to make them a villain,
mm-mm,
but let's say an owner of an NFL team gets caught at a massage parlor,
mm-hmm,
in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It is kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal, because heavy is the head that wears the crown. You're in a position of leadership, probably a celebrity, and it's just some things where the public is expecting you to know. And I mean, going to a massage parlor and getting something that starts with happy and you know, it is not ethical or moral behavior. Like, you know, it's against the law. So, like,
right.
But the
larger thing, and back to our point here, is more than likely, that person who is performing that service may have been a victim or is a victim of human trafficking.
Yeah. So there was a story, I think, in Florida or Georgia, where a young man went on a killing spree with women that were working in massage parlors. And immediately the media started calling it hate crime because he was a white gentleman. But for those of us who are in this anti-trafficking work, we already knew what it was. She was a sex trafficking victim, and he probably felt guilty, or not, maybe not felt guilty, or he found out what they were doing. And then when he was questioned by the police, his answer was, I wanted to kill my temptation, because he was a patron. He was an abuser. He was an exploiter. You know, so like a lot of times those individuals, especially at those massage parlors, we have massage parlors busted here in Western New York, all of 2024 and 2025.
Sure.
Yeah. And then, I mean, we just had a DEA agent go down for human trafficking, right, at a local strip club. These things are closer than we think. We had, an officer in Lancaster in the last 2 years arrested for, I believe, trafficking his wife and Lord knows who else. And so, again, not to just pinpoint these stories, but I do want people to understand, this stuff is a lot closer than what we think. And so preventative measures are necessary. Legislation that protects victims is necessary, that hopefully deters people from wanting to participate in a sex trade in any way is necessary. And so I think Project Mona's House, that's what we continue to do. We're going to continue to wave the banner of freedom. So as a descendant of those whose bodies were bought and sold, my one thing that I really believe in is that bodies should never be looked at as commodities, at all, for any reason. We can sell, we can sell apple juice. We can sell a cell phone, but never should we be selling somebody's body.
Let's hold it right there. That's okay. A great place to take a break, right? Okay. And we've got a lot to talk about. We're really getting off we're staying on the topic, the major subject here, but we're getting away from a few other elements when it comes to Project Mona's House. And our guest today, that's Kelly Galloway. We'll take a time out on What's Next. We'll be back with more. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media brings our community together with programs that inspire, inform, and entertain. Enjoy trusted news, local performances, educational resources, and cultural treasures all in one place. It's more than media. It's a connection to the world around you. Discover what Buffalo Toronto Public Media offers at btpm.org. This is Public Media.
The following episode contains sensitive content, including discussion of human trafficking, exploitation, and trauma. This material may be distressing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And welcome back to What's Next. Today, we're talking about human trafficking with Kelly Galloway, the president and founding director of Project Mona's House here in Buffalo. Kelly, since our last time together, you've been appointed to the New York State Task Force on Missing Women and Girls Who Are Black, Indigenous, and People of Color.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's a long name.
It is a long name for a task force. Sometimes I have trouble remembering it. I'm just I start putting words all over the place, but now I say, well, y'all get the point.
And but that being stated, though, talk about the work that you guys are doing.
So, I just want to shout out Assemblywoman Crystal Peoples-Stokes, who made the recommendation, because on that task force, I think it's about two of us who are direct service providers, meaning that we don't just work on legislation, we don't just work on prevention, but we actually work with the women. And so one of the things that we noticed that was happening, and a lot of complaints from all across New York State and really different parts around the country, really, is that when Black and Indigenous women were going missing, we were just automatically, especially our children, were automatically just being labeled as runaways. Nobody looking for them and nothing happening. But you have to ask yourself, like, there's three things that children need to survive when they, if they're outside of a safe place. And that's food, clothing, and shelter. And so what a trafficker or somebody that is trying to exploit them will do, they will provide them these things. And but it's never really free, right? And so what this task force is supposed to do and what we're working on is finding out, well, what really happened when they went missing. And so we've been doing a lot of listening sessions for children and adults. We've been learning a lot about cyber stalking, like all these different elements that affect this population. What happened? Who did it? Did you have any friends? Like, tell us everything about it so that we can start making and forming legislation that is really representing the population that we say that we want to serve. And so one thing that's going to do is like institute a statewide board of individuals who were trafficked, who were victims of maybe domestic violence, who were former who may have been kidnapped, or who are family members of individuals who are missing and murdered. And so with this task force, we've been doing research for about, I would say, like a year and a half. And now all of our findings are like here. And so we've had the opportunity to go over those things before we actually work with legislators to write laws that will hopefully allow us to bring people home a lot sooner, not write off so many Black and brown girls as runaways and Indigenous women as runaways. And then also to make sure that that everybody feels represented when somebody goes missing. And so that goes beyond just the Amber Alert. It's so many cold cases. And if somebody's a habitual, well, what people call like, oh, they run away all the time. Well, where are they running to?
Right.
Because harboring a runaway is also illegal. And so for us, we just want people to be in safe environments. And if home is not safe, well, what can we do to institute other practices where this child, until they become of age, can be in a safe environment? A lot of times youth are trafficked and they engage in something called survival sex just to have food and shelter and clothing. But this is going to address all those social determinants of health that even cause those type of situations. So did the kid run away, or did they get arrested, or did something happen because they were hungry? Do they have access to equal to safe housing? Are they like being neglected in any way, shape, form, or fashion? And so hopefully like this task force will be able to implement legislation that will prevent law enforcement from whoever from just labeling somebody as a runaway, but also give people the supports to go find those individuals, whether that's more mental health professionals, whether that's more clinical staff. And then hopefully after we draft the legislation, the House and the Senate will be able to vote, the Assembly and the Senate will be able to vote to allocate funding to make sure that this legislation can be implemented all across New York State. And so hopefully that will lead to a decrease and sex trafficking and domestic violence and other crimes that come just because people are missing.
Before we went on the air, you talked about a little bit about gaps in the way the laws are set up, gaps in, you know, where there are just places where people just, I hate to say slide through the cracks,
yes,
but that's the best,
it happens.
The best metaphor I can come up with. Give me an example. Take us through this so maybe we can all see this together, and perhaps, you know, if you can help one person, maybe you can help more than that.
Yeah, so one piece of legislation that we are working, it's two main pieces of legislation, but one that I really want to highlight today is Virginia's law. And so that is going to, hopefully that law will pass, and some federal legislation that will remove the procedural time barriers off of people telling their story.
Okay.
So a lot of times you'll say, okay, well, if something happened to you and it was over 10 years ago, it doesn't matter. You can't report it. There will be no consequences. You'll have to find justice another way. You'll have to create your own type of closure because you won't get closure from the government or the legal system at all. And so Virginia's law is named after one of Epstein's victims. And yeah. And so one of our senators, Senator Chuck Schumer, is one of the sponsors on that bill. And what it's going to do in layman's terms, basically is saying, like, we're not putting a time limit on your healing process. So sometimes people think that the clock should start when the abuse happens, but that's not the case. The clock really starts when somebody feels healed and safe enough to tell their story. So if somebody feel like it's going to be retaliation, they're probably going to hide. And it could be shame, it could be embarrassment, it could be fear that somebody's going to do something to them if they come forward. And so we should not put a time frame on somebody being feeling like, hey, I'm healed enough to finally tell my story. And then that legislation hopefully will challenge the everyday person to realize, like, just because that person didn't tell what happened to them today, it doesn't mean that their story should be any less believable tomorrow. It's just maybe the circumstances didn't make them feel safe enough that, or supported enough that they can come forward. We see all the time people come forward and society tears them apart.
Right.
Tears them apart. And so you feel like other people should feel safe enough to come forward. We don't even create safe atmospheres, not online, not in person, not in religious communities. And it's always somehow it always ends up being the victim's fault.
You mentioned that Virginia's law is named after a victim of
Jeffrey Epstein.
So I keep on jumping off on little tangents
okay.
here with you, but you handle it and you find a way to really bring it into light here. What have you made of the way this Epstein file case has been portrayed? What are you seeing in it that you think maybe is just missing? The point of what's really going on here?
So I may be the founding director of Project Wellness House, but I'm also an overcomer of sexual violence, where somebody that I really loved and trusted fought me for 45 minutes to try to abuse me. And at that time, that individual was in a relationship with somebody that I loved and trusted and considered a family member. And so I was going to fight until I couldn't fight anymore for that to not happen. And not everybody, I was supported. When I finally, it took me a week to tell anybody that happened to me, because I felt embarrassed. I felt ashamed. And I felt like somehow that person would make it seem like it was my fault. Even though it was my house, they walked in without knocking, and I understand what it feels like to maybe potentially have that fleeting thought that somebody's not going to believe me, because this is so unbelievable. When I think about the Jeffrey Epstein case, to me, if as an overcomer of sexual violence, it feels like if you have money, I'll never get justice.
Mm.
If I'm not famous enough, I'll never get justice. If I don't know the right people and have the right connections, if I come forward, then, and this person is more powerful than me, then nobody's going to respect my story. And then maybe I'll be made to be the victim. I'll be made to be the villain in that situation. And then the aggressor is really the victim. I hear a lot of times, how did these girls get in this type of situation? Or it always seems like it's the girl's fault when that man was a grown man. And his madam, Miss Maxwell, these are adult women preying on poor young girls. And that's why I always say poverty is the biggest pimp. And so you show somebody that's struggling to eat at night, or struggling, their mom is working 2 and 3 jobs, maybe dad is not around or vice versa. And you say, okay, well, listen, like, you can come to this house and maybe you could make some money. And they don't know what they're getting themselves into. They just, and what they use is they use a peer-to-peer, it's called a peer-to-peer recruitment method. And so after they recruited the first young girl, then they sent her out to recruit other young girls. And so again, when we even think about, like, scientifically and biologically, your prefrontal cortex isn't even fully developed until like 24 and 25. That's the decision-making part of your brain. These are children, but most times people want to rally behind kids unless you're rallying against the rich.
Mm. Well stated. And most certainly that's, we're seeing that in the coverage of the Epstein files.
Yeah, when y'all put the files out, I had never seen something so redacted.
Right.
But we care about trafficking victims, and we care about individuals who are abused. And so, and the crazy thing is, like, this goes beyond race. That story goes beyond race, because these girls were Black, white, Hispanic, Asian, but he was rich. And the individuals involved were also rich and powerful people. So it goes to show that, like, if you have enough connections, then maybe justice for the victim, they'll never get it. And so we are doing a press conference April 28th. With two Epstein victims in Albany. And so I'm just calling for, like, we just really want this law to be passed. Like, they deserve justice. They deserve justice. And it shouldn't be a time frame to say, okay, well, it's been over 10 years. But if I was trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein, he got money that can last 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Right.
And so, yeah, no, I wouldn't feel safe to come forward either, because I don't know what's going to happen to me or my family. And then again, the public, it's just like they are, like, victim shaming. April 29th in the United, not just in the United States, but all over the world, is Denim Day. Have you ever heard of Denim Day?
No.
So Denim Day is a day where people stand in solidarity for individuals who were victims of sexual violence. It comes from a story in the French Parliament where a man who raped a woman was freed because they said that it was no way that he could have sexually violated her because her jeans were so tight.
Oh.
And so it was no way, so it had to be consensual. So on April 29th, all over the world, we just wear denim. And I mean, for me, I'm gonna find the tightest pair of jeans I can find, you know. But again, it's still that victim shaming, victim blaming, and again, so Virginia's law will help to give people justice that's not on a clock.
We have been talking about human trafficking with Kelly Galloway today on What's Next. And of course, as we continue to outline it, the problem seems to be getting larger and larger and more unassailable. But there are success stories. We're going to get into some of those when we come back, when we talk more about Project Mona's House. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
What is BTPM Plus? It's an evolution of Buffalo Toronto Public Media that brings you the best of PBS, where you can watch your favorite programs live and dig into collections curated just for you. And here's the best part. When you stream BTPM Plus, you're not just watching, you're supporting your local public media station, the journalism, the arts, and the storytelling that keeps our community connected. Visit btpm.org/plus today. Stream smarter, stream local.
Looking for stories and conversations that matter? Buffalo Toronto Public Media delivers trusted journalism, inspiring arts, educational resources, and programs for the whole family at btpm.org. This is Public Media.
The following episode contains sensitive content, including discussion of human trafficking, exploitation, and trauma. This material may be distressing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
And thank you very much for joining us today on What's Next. My name is Jay Moran. Very privileged to have with us once again Kelly Galloway, President and Founding Director of Project Mona's House here in Buffalo. We've been talking about human trafficking throughout this program and getting into a lot of elements. And I appreciate Kelly, you know, taking us on this journey and educating us. And at the same time, I can't imagine there's anybody who's been listening that hasn't been totally absorbed in what we've been talking about here, because this is a very human story about some very inhumane activity, for sure. But at the same time, there are successes. And one of them, those successes are being seen at Project Mona's House. Mm-hmm. You have a residential program that is finding success? Explain.
Well, Project Wellness House, I always say, is West New York's first and only restoration, right now only, restoration home specifically for women who have been victims of human trafficking and exploitation. And so that an exploitation means that maybe they didn't necessarily have a trafficker, but they had an exploiter, somebody that was paying for sex and they're exiting prostitution, which is inherently violent. And so we are a 2-year residential support program for women who are enrolled in what we call the Overcomer Academy. And so that's like a 3-month program where we pay people $300 just to go through it. Workforce development, entrepreneurial endeavors, mental health, counseling, emotions, and a plethora of other subjects that are covered inside what we call the Free Them Center, named after my freedom walk, where I walked 902 miles on the Underground Railroad to raise awareness about human trafficking. And when people are talking about like our residential support program, we always let people know it's not a shelter. It is a program. Like if you go to UB, you stay in the dorms, right? And so, well, some people. And so if you're in an Overcomer Academy and you're in need of more stability, like according to like Maslow's hierarchy of needs, in order for somebody really rebuild, they need some stability so they can, if they qualify, they can move into Project Bonus House. And after 2 years or sometimes 2.5 years, we always say, like when people are like, well, Kelly, what makes Project Bonus House different than other programs? It's a lot of things, but this is one question in particular. Where do they go when they leave?
Sure.
And the question for us is, over 90% of our graduates, they move into homes that they own. So we utilize first-time homeowner programs. We have what we call a journey plan, which is to other people who might be in like my field of work, for them, that's called an individualized treatment plan. But we literally write out their life for like 2 years and where they should be, benchmarks, how you save. And so like we help them save their money for them. And so we want women, when they graduate, to at least have a 670 to $700 credit, 700 credit score, $10,000 in a savings account, $2,000 in a checking account, little to no debt, and a car that's paid off cash. And so we have great partners in Western New York that allow us to, we can pay like they are saving their money and paying like $8,000 to $9,000 for a car, and they do all the fixing and everything for as long as they're in our program.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's like a relationship we recently got within like the last 12 months. And so we're really grateful for
would
them.
Would you like to give props to someone or not? It's up to you. I'll leave you. You're the founder and president.
Yeah.
It's fine. That's fine. We'll move on from that.
But
I just wanted to offer that opportunity there because it does sound like it's so tremendous. But can you take us maybe just, you know, the privacy is always going to be first and foremost here, but take us through maybe somebody who came in to the academy, you saw where they were. I'm sure you have hope for everybody. It just seems like that's your DNA. But maybe somebody, boy, it'd be unbelievable if this person can make it through this because they've got these challenges. Mm-hmm. And then here they are 2 years, 2.5 years later, and they have these types of assets that you're talking about. Can you just maybe walk us through?
Like how they got there?
Just what they had to go up against, what they had to go through.
Well, I
know we've talked about that a lot, but, you know, again, it's different. When we have these discussions, we talk about everybody becomes an example, and you know, nobody wants to be a statistic, but in a way that is what we're talking about. But it's a person has to step in. They have to do this. They have to go through this mental, through all of these things to become healthy enough to be successful.
Yeah. So that's why we don't skip steps. And so even when I first started Project Wellness House, I would be so like excited. I'm so excited. Like they would trust us with their journey that sometimes we would skip steps. And now we learned that you cannot skip steps. And what I mean by that is, let's say somebody has, a lot of times people come to us and they have substance abuse issues. And so we are not a substance abuse clinic. And so like we know now we have amazing partners like Niagara Recovery, Clearview, White Deer Run, where our women can stay for up to 120 days and really work on that substance abuse issue because we can't fight against that. We've had like several women in our program get to like almost a year sober and then relapse. And when you talk about it, they might say, well, Kelly, like I started feeling like too comfortable or the celebration got to me, and I'm so used to all my life celebrating something and using substances. And so our best working relationship is with Erie County Medical Center on Main Street. Their substance abuse clinic, they've been working with me since 2018 and really helping me to like redefine my program. If a woman comes in with severe trauma, she might end up in our program for longer than 2 years because we have to dedicate those first couple of months to just her mental health. Like, it, can she work and can she go to school? Can she do all these things without, because it's going to be triggers everywhere. So it's not if something negative happens in your life, it's when something negative in your life happens, this is what you're going to do. And so like ECMC has a, like a dynamic program that we've had great success with. So shout out to Karen and Miss Angel down there. But one thing that I'm learning is, number one, their wins are not our wins and their losses are not our losses. And when we approach it from that aspect, I believe that we can take them all the way. So this is what I mean. You come into Project Wellness House, you get an intake. From there, we find out like, oh, okay, is this person, that they qualify for Project Wellness House? Because if you're in the Freedom Center, you just have to be a part of a vulnerable population.
Okay.
You don't have to be a trafficking victim. But if you're a part of a vulnerable population that can lead to trafficking, then we try to intercept that. And so they can become a part of Overcomer Academy. But if they have a history of trafficking or exploitation, then they can go through another process where they are psychological evaluation to see if Project Wellness House in a communal living space would be good for you. Because it's not good for everybody. And if we realize like, oh man, they really need housing, but they might not be a good fit, we work at a dynamic program that is called the Safe House Project, and they can match people in any of the 50 states.
Mm.
Yeah. And so based upon your interests and your preferences and things like that. But once a woman comes in and she stabilizes, she makes it through it's called the 90-day phase-in program. Once she makes it through that, then she probably will start seeking employment. She probably has finished Overcomer Academy and now she has some of the tools. They still have to go to counseling, you know, once a week for the remainder of their time within Project Wellness House. And depending on the level of trauma, whether a substance abuse is there, they still do outpatient. But if no substance abuse, just mental health. And then they get to start saving their money and they have their one-on-ones with their journey coaches. We assign all of them mentors. They have a community, a faith community. They have they are active like in community service.
Mm.
So we do a lot of work with the community fridge, Every Bottom Cover, 8 Days of Hope, and just like community cleanups. And so we try to get them also civically engaged so that they understand like, listen, there's going to be a point where you're going to be a contributing and functioning member of society. You need to understand the power of your vote, and your vote is your voice. And so we do that as well. And then I think from there, it's just they do life. We just do life with them.
Mm.
So after those first 90 days and where they go through Overcomer Academy, now we're just family. We're traveling together. We're eating. We're cooking together. We're planting flowers. Like we have this one lady. Her name is Maggie. She's coming over to like help us build out a garden. Mm. We've never grown our own food before, but we want to do that now. And, you know, so I think it's Project Wellness House, the one thing that I think that we do well is that we do life with people well. We just do people well. And so it's not a judgmental space, but again, it is challenging. It is not an easy program to go through. It's not an easy program to go through, but if you make it through those 2 years, it's going to be great.
Well worthwhile. And you know, our conversation goes fast. So our time is running short.
Okay.
How can people support Project Wellness House?
Well, the first thing I always want to do, education is the first form of prevention. Every single month, we offer a free human trafficking one-on-one training. You can either do the one-hour one or the intensive for 4 hours, which the four-hour one is taught by me. Secondly, you could partner in a way that is meaningful, where maybe you don't have the money, but you have the time. And I mean, you could lock arms with us and become a volunteer with our Young Women's Empowerment Academy, because that's like 127 girls. How do you save women? You do it by empowering girls.
Mm.
Or you can work with the women. And then finally, you know, you can bring your treasure and you can help us pay some bills. You know, we have like, it's five of us that really make this whole thing work. All the legislation, all the activities, events that you see, it's five people plus all of our dynamic volunteers as well. But you can join our volunteer family. And so April 16th, you can meet us at the Meriwether Library. That's our all hands meeting. If you want to learn more about Project Wonders House, experience our all hands meeting. And this time we're going to focus on what to do when you have to start again. And so the journey of people relapsing and coming back, or in the psychology. So we have some dynamic speakers that are going to be there. But yeah,
and they can find it all online at Project Mona's House.
Yep, www.projectmonas, and that's M-O-N-A-S house.com, www.projectmonashouse.com.
Now hopefully you were listening to Kelly Diane Galloway with us in this hour. I'm sorry that the subject matter is so dire.
I know,
it's always such a tremendous pleasure to have you with us, and thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. I will always have you back, despite what the minister might have meant by that. Project Mona's House, the president and founding director is Kelly Diane Galloway. She has been our guest on What's Next. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.